This is Union Days. Stories from a union scrapbook. When I was growing up, kids wanted to be astronauts, footballers, scientists, shop owners, but I knew I wanted to be part of the union world, part of the struggle for better jobs, safer conditions, greater equality. So I've worked in and for unions all my working life. It's been a huge privilege and a great experience. Vets, cops, lawyers, medics, footballers' wives, they all get to tell their tales. Now it's the turn of a union rep to open the scrapbook of stories. The people, places, scraps and scrapes, heroes and villains, tall tales and low blows. It's the stuff of life itself, and I can't wait to share these stories with you. Let's get started. Summer in the city. The sound of a well-oiled bolt being pulled back, immediately followed by the creak of the old pub door being reluctantly opened from the inside. A landlord's head poking out from the dark interior, lank white hair, the pallor of his skin suggesting minimal contact with daylight, and still less with the sunshine of what promised to be another hot, hot day. The landlord sniffed the air, took in the sight of us with a languid glance, and shuffled back into the bar, allowing us to enter. My eyes adjusted to the gloom quickly. Dust particles danced in shafts of sunlight, making silhouettes of the wooden lattice window frames. This natural light was all that we had, the landlord too busy now, cleaning the bar with pledge and a suspicious-looking cloth. Geoffrey, Jerome and Percy stood lounge side of the bar, deep in conversation. But despite the genuinely pressing and unpleasant employment issue that Percy, a near neighbour whose daughter was at primary school with my own, had asked to urgently speak to me about, this was not the preoccupation of these three besuited, well-spoken, highly educated, and sensitively palated gentlemen. I tuned into the conversation, keen to sit down and find out more about their work-related concerns. Pinot, it seemed, was out of the question. Sauvignon was altogether too frivolous for the serious circumstances in which they found themselves. That pointed firmly to Chardonnay. It just had to be French. Of course, but which region? Pouligny, Montrachet, Meursault or Mâcon Village? And then what vintage? 2000, do you think? No, 1990. Or if they have it, and it's a Mâconnais, then surely 1982 must be the choice. Concise but intense negotiation with the landlord, whom I have to confess looked an unlikely viticulturalist to me, and an impromptu tasting session. 1982 vintage, yes, but only the Meursault was available. If Sir could accept the 1990 instead, regarded by some as superior, then an exquisite Mâcon Village could be at the gentleman's disposal, opined the bartender. With the major issue at hand now resolved, Percy and his colleagues could turn to other matters. Like an imminent and forced departure from their employment at the Wine Research Foundation? Well, more imminent and more forced for Percy than the other two. Now, I don't know if you've heard of or how well you know the Wine Research Foundation, so forgive me if I go over stuff you might know already. The Foundation is, of course, the preeminent trade body in England and Wales when it comes to classification, categorisation and pathology of wine. Its yearbook, Wine Today, has been published every year since 1928, Second World War excepted, and is regarded as the Bible, encyclopedia and oracle of the industry. Though its title leaves me thirsty to know what came yesterday and what will happen tomorrow. But all was clearly not well in the world of wine, and not just because the Foundation's chief executive is both fond of self-aggrandisement and almost allergic to those who say no or who disagree with it. This means that you may be both justified and tempted to query whether he really is, as he claims, accredited as the Grand Master of Ceremonies for the Moldavian Grape and Grain Conclave, which dates back to Tsarist times. But you would certainly be ill-advised to disagree with his answer. That is, unless you wanted to seek alternative employment. Usually, people just avoided him. Which is what Percy had done up until, in preparing the forthcoming yearbook, he had to confront the pathology of natural wines. Now, natural wines were even more of a novelty, and no offence meant, then than they are now. Percy was ambivalent, but on balance felt there was not enough in the natural wine space for him to place them alongside and as equal partners to those wines of longer, more authoritative standing. Nothing to do with drinkability, you understand, but everything to do with pedigree. Now, the Foundation's Human Resources Director had pulled Percy up on this. Hang on, you're thinking, I can tell. What's the yearbook's editorial stance got to do with HR? The answer is nothing in any rational world, but the HR director is in truth only the HR director because the chief executive's wife is the badminton partner of the HR director's hubby. And the HR director's hubby is president of the Société Nationale du Vin Naturel. Small world, this wine business, I thought. To cut a long story short, Percy was asked to redraft the yearbook to give prominence to natural wines. He refused and was then instructed to redraft the yearbook. He refused again and may have said something about ethics and editorial integrity or some such thing. The HR director told the CEO, who told Percy, rewrite the damn yearbook. And that's how Percy ended up saying no to the person who really, really can't take being said no to. And then, out of the blue, the Foundation found itself in a redundancy situation. No one saw this coming, and no one could quite understand it. But as the law requires, a pool was formed of those deemed to be at risk of redundancy, namely Geoffrey, Jerome, and, yes, Percy, the three senior inspectors. Except it was a front. Geoffrey and Jerome were only window dressing. Percy was the target, and as soon as the penny dropped, he asked if I might be able to advise. Now, Percy was a union member and had been for years, even though he'd never felt the need to use our services. He was just about the only member at the Foundation, and the Foundation didn't or wouldn't recognise a union anyway. But he was being shafted by an arrogant, entitled, overbearing, unethical employer. His Maddie was besties with my Jody at school, and it was time to activate the insurance policy that union membership often is. I knew I could help. At this time, as the Foundation was a non-recognised area, I had no rights, no standing, but I could tell Percy what he might like to write, and I could judge pretty accurately what the Foundation would do at each step. And I could and did help Percy get the best deal he could financially and protect his access to freelance consultancy work. I did also manage to get a message to the Foundation's chief investor, whose own HR director was a former union rep I'd worked with many years previously. They, the investors, also happened to provide the chair of the Foundation's Board of Trustees, to whom the Foundation's chief executive and senior management are accountable. Let's just say that the Wine Research Foundation's chief executive and HR director didn't work in the sector for much longer. A small world indeed. Drink crops up an awful lot in workplace issues. I suppose it seems strange nowadays, but alcohol and work were much more closely connected, even as recently as 30 years ago, than they are now. When I worked at one trade union's national headquarters, there was actually a full bar attached to the staff canteen. And you knew which colleagues were, shall we say, less productive after lunch. But it's the double standards that also applied that are so appalling. A colleague told me of a bank clerk who actually had an alcohol problem. She would have a couple of pints each lunchtime, and the afternoons were jollier than the mornings, but customers didn't notice and the work got done. But then things took a less amiable turn. The drinking increased. Customer service became less reliable, and then downright unpredictable. Mistakes started to happen, complaints were made, and the whole thing came crashing down when she came into work after a liquid breakfast, had more at lunchtime, and couldn't talk or see straight by 3:30. So, what happened? I asked.
Suspended pending dismissal. We had a ton of mitigation. Dependent and deteriorating mother, single parent family, teenage kid not going to school, and crucially, the bank knew her difficulties but cut her no slack.
How did the bank respond then?
Not well. As you'd expect, really, but our member was totally open about what she'd done and her circumstances. It was a relief for her, really. Stopped drinking altogether, was able to get some help, but the bank just said no. No mitigation, zero tolerance. And the drinking was fundamentally her fault. I mean, I knew we weren't going to save her job, but I was hoping for some sort of deal.
And she laughed. Why so funny? I asked.
Well, we got a deal. We got a deal when after the final appeal meeting, our member told me that every Friday afternoon, the manager of her branch opened the drinks cabinet in his office and everyone could just help themselves. Hadn't thought to tell me before. Zero tolerance, my arse.
It's strange just how really obvious and important things, like the bank manager's drinks cabinet, are just part of the everyday, unremarkable features of the landscape until something, some shock, happens to shake people out of that mindset. That's what I was thinking as I stood opposite a large young man who was telling me about his work. He really was large, very overweight, but on top of a large frame anyway. We met because his health had taken a turn for the worse and the company were getting angsty about his sick leave record. He told me how each working day a driver in a company vehicle would call at his flat. Then off they would go to six, sometimes more but never less, of the pubs stocking this brewery's products. Terry, this lad was called. Terry's job was QA, quality assurance. And company rules meant that quality assurance was accomplished by sinking a pint in each establishment visited. Hence the car and driver, I guess. The problem is that Terry had, unsurprisingly, developed a taste for the stuff in the course of his work. And with the staff discount in the brewery shop, it was too easy to continue the day's work at home with a few cans. How are you feeling? I asked Terry with some incredulity. Pretty shite, answered Terry truthfully. How long have you been in the job? I asked. Only about 18 months. What happened to the guy before you? I said. Oh, it's very sad, said Terry. He weren't so old, but he died.
Died?
I said.
Yes, cirrhosis of the liver,
said Terry with an absolute straight face. I'm relieved to report that the company changed its QA requirements pretty soon after that. Working for a drinks manufacturer or a brewery or distillery like Terry, as opposed to a trade body like Percy, does lead to different sorts of issues. But overconsumption, like the bank clerk, is often at the root of any trouble. It's rooted in history, you see. Brewing used to be an overwhelmingly manual occupation, from physically carrying the raw materials, hops and barley mostly, but sugar too, to the processing and delivery of the end product in barrels, officially 288 pints, and hogsheads, which are 432 pints. And also historically, often the water quality wasn't so good, and in any event, beer can rehydrate you more quickly. It's almost isotonic, some say. So, what do you give your thirsty and dehydrated workers? What is very readily to hand? Beer, of course. And a whole culture built up around drinking at work, like a crew of three on the horse-drawn drays used for deliveries. The most junior of the trio would drive, because the more senior pair would be blind drunk. But history never stands still, does it? Breweries moved from being wet and full of manual work to dry and predominantly automated. In that evolution, the custom and practice of brewery workers drinking on the job and drinking while at work full stop slowly disappeared. But not without incident. In one well-established large brewery, tokens equating to 2 pints per day were part and parcel of manual workers' terms and conditions well after the need for rapid rehydration had gone, and well after delivery vans replaced those one-person-sober, two-not dray teams. But surely, I asked someone who'd been there at the time, this benefit in kind was not given up without a struggle. Well, it turns out that the tokens had fallen into a bit of disrepute. They could only be redeemed in pint dispensing machines in the brewery's mess hall, but of course, whoever is responsible for emptying the machines can quite easily pocket half the tokens and dole them out to mates or in exchange for favours. Similarly, the tokens of those who didn't drink, and even of those who did, contributed to a black market trading everything from mundane or unpleasant tasks to swapping shifts so that those who wanted to and had enough to trade could keep Saturday afternoons free to follow their favourite team in person. The perils of mixing free beer at work with a proliferation of forklift trucks was amply illustrated by a near-miss crash one Wednesday afternoon. Gary was on the FLT, as forklift trucks are known, had his 2 tokens worth of free beer at lunchtime, and then back behind the wheel, got distracted, and went straight into a pile of pallets by the side of the tank in which beer is being stored before being filtered. The impact violently nudged the pallets, which in turn upended a worker over the balustrade and splash into the beer. It could, of course, have been much worse, as everyone struggling not to giggle readily agreed. The beer-soaked employee was heard to bemoan his failure to be holding a pint glass at the time, but it kind of made the argument that heavy machinery and booze don't go well together. Tokens were replaced by vouchers, redeemable in the brewery shop for consumption off-site. The beer tank also sometimes, in yesteryear, used to attract rats, who would occasionally fall off the balustrade and into the beer. They'd drown and rise to the surface, but bottom first. The colloquial term, being rat-arsed, apparently comes from this. It seems that the less regulated drink-at-work arrangements were, the more dramatic or sudden was their demise. One large brewery had help-yourself beer pumps on the server of the works canteen. The idea was that the staff coming off night shift could end their working day with a pint or two before they went home to bed. Hindsight is a marvellous thing, and this employer had buckets of it when it came to not being able to get rid of the beer pumps, even though the minority now using them were drinking more and more. The site rep was a big guy, John Joe, a man of passion. He loved his beer, his job, his union, and Saracens Rugby Football Club, but not necessarily always in that order. He was also a natural leader. Partly it was his size, his height, his girth. Partly it was the way he spoke, the way he captured and distilled what his members wanted when he sat down with management, or reporting back to a branch meeting. He delivered for his members, and he was well-liked and respected for it. "You'll see," John Joe said, spreading his large hands as if to calm turbulent waters. "It will cause upset. The boys and girls just won't understand it, see? Won't like it and feel disrespected." The brewery's operations and HR managers looked wearily at each other. "Productivity will suffer for sure. There's the contractual angle too. An established benefit in kind. But most of all, it's a matter of trust." The management team knew when they weren't going to make progress.
"Okay, Georgia,"
said the ops manager.
"But this can't go on forever."
She pointed her pen in John Joe's direction.
"We're outliers on this now. Morelands have scrapped beer in the canteen. Impetus has replaced pints with vouchers. Sterling's director told me staff absence declined by 20% after they went dry."
John Joe gave a falsely deprecating smile. He knew exactly what was happening at those other breweries. But that was there, and he was here. He and his members wouldn't be rolled over. Not on this. Not on anything. When the FLT John Joe was driving crashed into the brewery's wall some weeks later, the impact buckled the prongs of the fork so that they stood vertically, a full 90 degrees different to their original horizontal plane. The driver seemed disorientated and confused. Willing hands helped him off the truck and into the first aid room, where he was found peacefully sleeping by the ops manager, not 10 minutes later. As you can imagine, word spread quickly.
Have you heard?
Yes, I can't believe it.
Must have been a fault with a truck. That then in the wall, the brickwork's all smashed.
I heard he passed out, probably the shock. And maybe he's got a sickness.
Oh, I do hope he's all right.
I hope they don't think it was his fault.
I bet they bloody do.
Poor John Joe.
Poor John Joe.
Poor John Joe indeed. Alex, the HR assistant, drove the now awakened John Joe to A&E, squeezing the big man into his Fiat 500, and waited with him till he'd been triaged, examined, blood tested, and declared safe to go home some 4.5 hours later. John Joe didn't say very much, reported back Alex. But then, thought the ops manager, there isn't a lot to say when someone drinks 4 pints and jumps onto a dangerous piece of machinery. She was damn sure that was what had happened here. The new day saw John Joe signed off and at home. Rumours that he'd actually been suspended were quickly dismissed. This is John Joe we're talking about. He's had a nasty shock yesterday. He needs to rest and recover properly. I found out all this before going to see the HR manager from Tracy, John Joe's union deputy. Is there anything else at all that I need to know? I asked her.
Nothing really.
The look on my face made words unnecessary.
Okay. Well, look. It's probably nothing. God, I can't believe I'm about to say this. John Joe told me he was having a problem with drink. How he couldn't take it like he used to, when he was younger like, but he just couldn't stop tanking it down himself. I thought it was just a passing thing, that he was on top of it, had got pills or something from the doctor. Oh, I feel so bad telling you this. It's probably nothing to do with the accident. Oh, Christ, don't tell him I told you. Oh, shit, what's going to happen now?
I just don't know, I said. But thank you for sharing. In reality, I think Tracy had just saved John Joe's job. You see, the company had done its homework, Tracy told me. No mechanical fault with the FLT. No blood tests because John Joe hadn't released them. But CCTV in the canteen had footage of him with a pint in his hand and 3 more on the table in front of him. Pointless to try and argue anything to the contrary. But thanks to Tracy, I knew that before even going in the room with management. And because I knew, I had time to think. I knocked on the door and went in. Alongside the HR manager and ops director were 2 others from the management team. Somber faces from the other side of the table as the tech report and stills from the camera were passed over to me. But some sadness too. And the ops director looked positively anxious. John Joe was an institution. Thought of fondly for the most part, and with respect. I made a gesture with my hands and face. And so, what now? It asked. You must have something on your mind, I said, or you would have just sacked him. Mind you, I can think of all sorts of reasons why you haven't. Some nervous coughing and straightening of ties by those wearing them. So, why don't you tell me why you haven't sacked him, that is? I paused for effect. Could it be something to do with the medication and all? Worried glances around the room. Shit!
What medication?
Who knew? Who should have known?
Look,
the ops director said.
I like John Joe. He's a good rep and a good worker. Can be a bit of an arse sometimes, but he's not unique in that. But medication or no medication, we can't let this one go. Someone could have been badly hurt, or worse.
I sniffed an opportunity here, but it might not have been madly popular. I understand, I said, playing for time. Perhaps, Perhaps it would be appropriate to look at systems rather than individuals.
What do you mean?
Do go on.
Tell us more,
said three of the people sat opposite me, all at the same time. Well, I understand, I said, checking my notes. But Morelands have scrapped beer in the canteen. Empties have replaced pints with vouchers, and at Stirling, staff absence declined by 20% after they went dry. Seems to me that you could say you're a bit of a, well, outlier, with arguably unsafe and therefore unlawful systems of work. And so the deal was done. John Joe kept his job, the workers kept their rep. Beer in the canteen was replaced with vouchers, and no one shed a tear. It was an idea, a habit, that had just run its course. And John Joe's medication? What medication? I don't think I ever said he was on medication. You may have thought that I implied that he was, but that's a different thing entirely. In the hospitality and food and drink industries, where deep and entrenched pockets of low-paid jobs exist in very close proximity to food, it's not a question of a couple of free pints being a legacy from old ways of working or a perk of the job. No, in these industries, being provided with a meal or a subsidised or even free staff canteen is a vital part of the employment package. But one minimum wage paying food manufacturer found they had badly misjudged the needs of their workers and the consequences of management policies when the established for years free breakfast for staff was abolished on affordability grounds. We argued that it was an entirely false and unsustainable economy, that hungry workers were not the most effective workers, that anxiety about hunger was almost as debilitating as hunger itself. The UK management said they were beholden to a policy change at global leadership level, and the global leaders were of the "we don't talk to unions" persuasion. Well, you'll have a problem with the misshapes, we prophesied. The misshapes are items that taste and smell the same as pucker products, but get rejected because of their appearance or size. Company policy was that these were to be thrown away.
Oh, there may be some problem that you can't see that makes them unfit to eat, was one line. We can't have people taking misshapes off the belt and walking around all shift with unwrapped food in their overalls, was another.
Tony was the last quality check on belt 6. In those pre-AI days, the last quality check checks that every item going forward to waste is actually faulty. And Tony was hungry. For breakfast, the kids had had the last of the cereal, the last of the milk, which he'd watered down but hoped they hadn't noticed. His cup of black tea and 2 sugars had warmed his empty stomach, but not for long. I won't go on because, frankly, hungry or not, what happened to Tony was a disgrace, which, as is sometimes the way of things, was also the start of something magnificent. The delinquent pan-o-raisin pastries came down the belt, all clearly substandard by virtue of being more like ring donuts than an elegant laminated swirl. In what Tony later described to me as a slow-motion dreamlike sequence, he leant forward and scooped up one pastry and ate it. And God, it tasted divine. Now, if Tony was committed to this subterfuge, you'd think he would have checked his surroundings, that he wasn't being watched or capable of being seen. You'd definitely do that, wouldn't you, if you wanted to be sly, undetected?
Tony didn't do any of that. He was fixated by his hunger and the ability to do something about it. That consumed him entirely.
That explains why he didn't see you, I explained to his manager at his disciplinary hearing. He didn't even look at the clock hanging almost straight in front of him to make sure one of the daily line inspections wasn't due. He acted entirely involuntarily. No dice. No chance. Dismissed without notice. For theft. Not only stupid, but cruel and mean to boot. Tony's partner Vinny also worked at the plant and was also our union's delegate to the local trades council. Perhaps that helps to explain how suddenly Tony became something of the talk of the factory, of the town. Everyone, it seemed, was talking about what had happened to him. And everyone, it seemed, shared the same view as us, this was just wrong. This was before the current proliferation of food banks, but the Trades Council organised a collection to keep Tony and Vinnie and the kids fed and their household bills paid. Reinstate Tony! Stickers appeared on every surface imaginable in a half-mile radius around the factory, including all the senior manager's cars in the car park. They were a right bugger to scrape off, I'm told. Then the local press picked up the story. And then the regional TV. And then questions got asked in the Commons by local MPs. And after a mystery bug laid low all but a handful of the 770 people who worked at the plant and halted production for a week, after that, then national networks started sniffing around. My colleagues in comms played a blinder. Charlie worked the phones to get the maximum reach, pumping social media, feeding the media machine, pushing home the message, protecting access to Tony too. Our sister unions in North America picked up the campaign, lobbied the company at global level. It certainly seemed that what had happened to Tony chimed with an almost global zeitgeist. People were fed up with such extreme unfairness and stupidity. And far too many people thought, that could so easily be me. Sacked for theft of something that was going to be thrown away, destroyed, something worthless to the manufacturer, but vital to the employee. This particular story had a happy ending. Turned out the one thing the company liked less than talking to unions was the population at large thinking they were scumbags and boycotting their products. Tony was offered his old job back, but politely declined. He'd had a better offer, thanks very much. Vinny stayed, though. And as the local branch of the union went from strength to strength under her stewardship, management found out that not only were they obliged to talk to the union, but that also the discussions were usually fruitful. And I'll drink to that. Cheers.
This has been Union Days, scenes from a union scrapbook with me, Simon Sapper. Music is by Scott Holmes. Production by Makes You Think.
All characters in this podcast are fictitious, and any resemblance to real persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
Subscribe, rate and review on the podcast platform of your choice. You can email the show at info@makesyouthink.com. Thanks for listening.